of education, of getting the messages out there so that, once again, ISPs are geared up to be able to answer some of those points. It's incredibly important for us. So yesterday at our meeting on that particular issue, we met with the people who are involved in the IDN variant work as well. And we said to them, there are clearly policy issues around here where there are going to be differences depending on the script, depending on the language, how they're implemented, what the real problems are. And basically, we need to produce some form of bibliography where we pull that information together and we focus our efforts on a particular part of the world that will be at the primary source of those inquiries, but also provide, because the internet is global, provide that information in a way that's easily understood for others as well. So that work and the very issue that you raised is one that I think we're behind the curve on. And to be quite honest, it's the same issue with the work on universal acceptance of GTLDs. I can now have a team in-house who are trying to look at every aspect of that, partly driven from the experience that we had before. But in an ideal world, we would have been doing that probably 18 months ago. But the focus, it's been such a vast program, the focus has been elsewhere. Now we're really tackling these issues, and we're running to keep up. So there's a lot of work to be done in that area, and a lot of it is purely understanding, education, and outreach. And we are using various methods to try and achieve that aim. We are producing publications, and we will be now focusing on IDNs, providing particular briefings to our community, because we need to put it into language that they clearly understand. The other part of that is that we are attending a number of regional meetings as a group where we go along. We not only talk about ICANN and some of the challenges and changes, some of the exciting things ICANN are doing, but we put aside some time where we meet specifically with our community and say, these are the issues, these are the things you really need to know. And it helps our thinking as well, because we get quite a lot of feedback. It's a two-way channel. So it's an incredibly busy period for ISPs, but because of the changes, quite an exciting time as well. And that's part of being involved in this area. I think you're never going to be bored if you're following ICANN, because every step along the way, there are changes that impact certainly ISPs at every level. So we've indulged in some of the policy discussions that have set the environment for the introduction of new top-level domains. But for us, now we're getting to the real challenging part, because these things are going to be out there. They've got to work, and people have got to understand them. And that's what we see as part of our role. So the very issue that you pick up on is one that was discussed yesterday and has given us a pretty large volume of work to take forward. Are there any other specific questions on any aspects of ISPs? Yes, sir.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Yusuf Ahmed from University of Ghana. I would like to know, how different is your work from the registries? The registrars.
Registrars?
Yes.
Right. Well, I mentioned in some part of the world, our members are registrars. And obviously, there is a registrar constituency here. But I think a lot of the focus for that particular part of ICANN, it's been on pure registrar policies and how they'll actually be implemented across the developing namespace. For us, it's almost a different set of issues, because for registrars, they're in a position where they can focus on their actual registrar business. For us, where we have ISPs as registrars, they're in exactly the same position as the other ISPs. They're going to be the first line port of call for inquiries. So the information we need to give them, again, is slightly different. It's actually being able to provide that interface from a technical perspective rather than just from a pure registrar business. Mm-hmm. And that's where we have this flexibility, or rather a flexible environment because the focus of ISPs in some parts of the world is slightly different in some areas, and it's understanding that local environment. That's why it's so important that as a constituency we have some global reach and we have that representation to try and steer us in the right way. South America, we are very strong. In Asia, we're very strong. In Africa, we're not so strong. And a lot of the work that we need to do in the next 12 months is trying to make that linkage with African ISPs so much stronger. We don't have it across all of the African continent. It's something which we haven't found easy to achieve for a whole variety of reasons. But in terms of actually engaging with that community, bringing them in to the ICANN family, it's something now that's really a frontline issue for us. So I hope that answered your question.
Martin. Sorry, Martin first. Okay, Amparo. Go ahead, Amparo.
Well, tengo tres pequeñas preguntas.
Amparo speaking. I have three questions. I come from the Dominican Republic, and my first question is the following. You say that you are very strong in Latin America, and I wanted to know whether in the Caribbean, and particularly in the Dominican Republic, if you have any presence there, if you have any participation in this debate. And I make this question because we are setting up a national committee, a mechanism related to internet governance issues. We are defining the agenda in relation to the ICANN agenda. And when we see how our ISPs are involved, in my opinion, they do not have a clear idea of what the content of the discussions in ICANN is about. I mean, I don't think they really know about it. So I wanted to check that with you. And eventually, though this is a topic of global discussion, it is also very important for us nationally that our providers should become engaged in this global discussion. And the second question I have is, what is your action in terms to the IPv6 transition from the perspective of providers? Because in the Dominican Republic, the regulatory authority I work for, Indotel, our intention is to become the top-class institution in the government to being ready for IPv6. And we couldn't work easy with our provider because they are sort of lagging behind. So what is going on in this respect? And the third question is the following. To what extent will you be impacted by the IANA transition? Are you in any way related to this or not? Thank you.
Thank you very much for those questions. On the first point, I was racking my brains as you were speaking, and I do not believe we have a direct relationship with your country in terms of ISPs. I think we do through one of our associations, but that makes the message diluted as it goes down the chain. What I would be very keen to do is to speak with you and exchange business cards, because I feel that making that relationship would help us and help your ISP. So any help you can give us to actually have a direct one-to-one relationship with ISPs in your country through whatever channel would be really appreciated. That's the sort of outreach activities that we're trying to do. And I will go back and check our membership list to make sure I'm correct on that, but I'm pretty sure that's the situation. On IPv6, you speak about something that's very close to my heart, and for a number of years, I've certainly been trying to champion that in every way. There are some parts of the world where They're far more advanced in IPv6 than others, which you're probably aware of. In most of those cases, there has been some form of incentive or help, particularly from governments, to make those changes. In Asia, where they took great strides very quickly, in most of those situations, there were some incentives. And I don't particularly mean monetary incentives, but the climate and the environment was correct for IPv6 to be introduced. The sort of things that really stimulated those activities were when large parts of the organisation, and it includes governments in some cases, they actually promoted IPv6 themselves. So they made sure that when they were procuring equipment, it was IPv6 compatible. That became something that had to be provided. And it created a market that flourished. And if there's one thing that really seems to help introduce IPv6 quickly, it's where you have those types of changes where you have to be IPv6 compliant as you introduce new equipment and you upgrade your network. Even in Europe, there are places where that doesn't happen. In fact, the UK is one of the places where we've, as ISPs, we've had lots of discussions with our government trying to create that climate. For a whole variety of reasons, it hasn't happened in the way that we would want. And, of course, now we're at the stage where basically the V4 space is gone. So people have to make those changes, and it becomes a lot harder. It is about facilitating the environment. And I can see a number of places, even in Europe, where ISPs are still very keen on adopting practices that prolong the life of IPv4. For instance, the introduction of things like carrier-grade NATs, where you can have a vast amount of V4 address space behind a single address. There are problems with those approaches. There are certain things that don't work very well that tend to break, but it does prolong the life of the V4 space. And it's always been pretty hard in any company, and I accept this, to go along to a board of directors and say, we need to make these changes, we need to invest in IPv6. And the first question they ask is, what does that actually deliver to us in terms of our business? And you can make the case, well, you're going to run out of address space of IPv4, but it doesn't actually help their cash flow or their profits to make those changes. So it's a business cost. And business, they always put off costs for as long as they can, yeah, unless there's a return. And that's the uphill struggle that's actually happened with IPv6. It's becoming more and more acute now, and I think a lot of people are accepting, okay, we're going to have to do it now because there just isn't the space there. I also believe that maybe we pursued IPv6 a little bit too hard in the early days, when it was really a decision of whether you wanted to move to this new technology or not at that time. You didn't have to do it. But the content at the IPv6 level wasn't there either. So you could actually run IPv6 addresses, but all of the content that you wanted to access over the internet was basically IPv4. So that's changing. The whole thing is changing now. But still, we've got a long, long way to go to actually get everybody into an environment where they're moving to IPv6, and IPv4 is going to be around for a long, long time. I think maybe it's on this particular issue, so sure, I'll come back to your last question in a moment.
Let's go to Gui first before.
I've obviously stimulated something.
Yeah, we don't want to have a long line. Yeah, but we'll do it like that. So we'll do Martin Hui, Gui, and yeah, okay.
Okay, thanks. I'm Martin. My question is, does the ISP and connectivity providers constituency have a program or a strategy to help new ISPs to reach places like, for example, in Argentina we have not only remote sites, but we also have inside of Buenos Aires, a big city, hyper-connected places where we don't have internet access because of the social struggles, or because it's difficult to ISP to provide the service there because it's difficult to charge it, basically shanty towns, you know? So regarding this reach out to undeveloped areas of ISP providers, do you have any kind of programs? And I'm talking not only financially, I'm talking also about cooperation. You know, maybe a smaller ISP with an alliance, with a bigger ISP, can do the work that neither of them can do by themselves. Thanks.
The answer to that is, as a constituency, no, because we only have the ability really to focus on a range of issues that are specific to our industry, most of which, well, all of it, I think, from a constituency perspective, is driven by the ICANN agenda. I'm certainly aware of that issue because of the involvement we have with particularly the South American region. But it has to be done through the national and regional associations. So the only way we really become involved in that is when we run our seminars, and certainly we do our outreach. It's with the local community. So they are the people that actually face the challenges head on there. But as an ICANN constituency, no, we just don't have the ability to handle that type of thing. There are people who are far better placed to do that than we are. I wonder, just one second, I wonder if I should just complete my answer to you on IANA, because that is an important point. And the answer to that is yes, it does impact us, because the range of things that IANA does is really quite small, but incredibly important. And the fact that any changes to identifiers that are going to happen in the route goes through IANA, well, for protocol changes, and if you look at what IANA does, the bulk of their work isn't actually around domain names and IP addresses. The bulk of their actual work is around changes to other identifiers, protocol changes, which is really the lifeblood of a lot of the technical operations for ISPs. So, yes, incredibly important. We will be engaging in those debates. And even now, we're at the stage where you've probably seen the plan for the coordination committee for the IANA activity. And within that, one of the things which we found challenging was there's one space on there for the commercial stakeholder group. So you have the business constituency, you have the intellectual property constituency, and you have ISPs. And we have one space on the coordination committee. And certainly the view of our members is that out of those three constituencies, it's probably more pertinent to us than the others. We're still having that argument and we haven't resolved it. But that's certainly giving you an indication as to how important that real issue is to ISPs.
Gui.
Please.
Oh, let us do the order. So can we go Gui, then we come to you? Huh? Okay, you want to go? Okay. All right, you could go ahead.
Merci, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes, for your presentation. I'd like to ask you a question and make a comment. First, the question. We have in Tunisia a project around the question of the internet providers and their statute. And we have asked the administration to make a consultation in which we wanted to be associated. I'm from the Tunisian Association of Information and Communication Technology. We asked to be associated to this consultation. What is the result of this decree project? There is a kind of analogy between the ISP and the access providers, the internet access providers. And I would say that the ISP are more important, and there are some merge between both sides, or sometimes the ISP want to be stronger than the other side. This create a kind of monopoly, and the ISP, between the ISP and the access provisioners. So what is your opinion about this question? My comment is about IPv6. I have heard a lot of comments about the deployment and the transition from IPv4 to IPv6. A lot of people think it's about resources. It's about the amount of resources. But I think that this must be analyzed in terms of risk, of exclusion risk, or loss of connectivity regarding the rest of the internet community. And I like you to answer a question. At what point are we going to stop thinking about IPv4? There must be a cohabitation period, but normally in this kind of situation, you have to decide that from this date on, we are not working with IPv4 anymore. What do you think about that?
The issue of the tensions between ISPs and access providers, it's a different proposition in different parts of the world, and I think you alluded to that in your statement. The key thing in any environment, I firmly believe, is getting the correct level of competition. And as soon as you get dominance in any of those sectors by any of those players, then I don't think the market's going to flourish. And experience just points to the fact that everywhere we are in a position of providing access to millions of more people at a cost that they can afford, the key drivers for that are always competition, being able to make sure that everybody competes at that level. And in some parts of the world, the environment doesn't facilitate that. I think that's the greatest inhibitor to the growth of the internet in those areas there is. And obviously, from a national perspective, the role of governments is incredibly important in facilitating that competitive element. So if you don't have a reason to change, those who have that stranglehold on the market, they're not going to change. They'll just get stronger. And I don't believe it's healthy in any perspective to do that. So that's the first point. In terms of IPv4, IPv6. IPv4 is going to be with us for a long, long, long time. There isn't going to be a date set where we basically turn that off. What will happen, I believe, is that most of the content capability will, over a period of time, move to IPv6. But, of course, because you have the dual way of working, you can tunnel IPv4 and IPv6 so that you still have access to everything that can be provided in that manner, unless it's specific content delivered IPv6 only. So over a period of time, the usage of IPv4 will decline. It will decline because you have to upgrade your network at times, and you'll be buying routers that give you that V6 capability. But it isn't going to go away. It isn't going to go away for a number of decades, I believe. I think it will be a slow transition, and we won't have the same tensions that we have today because all of the equipment out there, the infrastructure, will be moving into V6, driven by things like the Internet of Things, where there'll be a vast pull on IPv6 address space, and all of these new innovations, some of which we probably can't even imagine today, are going to help make that transition. But it isn't going to be switched off, and it isn't going to go away. It's going to be just this gradual evolution which will take place organically and take place at different paces in different parts of the world as well. I think I picked up on all of those.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Unfortunately, we don't have time for more questions on this particular subject. But by all means, please feel free to contact Tony Holmes outside of this meeting, and he'll be happy to answer any questions. Our next speaker is here.
Just one point, if I may. I'm certainly very pleased to answer any questions, and please contact me either around the conference or via email or whatever. But one thing I will do before I go is I'll make sure that we deliver down to you a set of our current brochures. So that has the contact points on, and it also has some information that may also help some of the questions I haven't been able to answer. Thank you.
So thank you very, very much, Chen Holmes. We will have our next speaker up without further ado. He's going to start his presentation. Remember, we are trying to beat the time so we can have the group photo at 8:45. Thank you.
All the way at the end of the table here is Byron Holland, who's the chair of the Country Codename Supporting Organization. And he will be here to give a presentation and be able to answer questions. So thank you, Byron. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, everybody. As mentioned, my name is Byron Holland. I'm chair of the Country Code Name Supporting Organization, one of the supporting structures of ICANN. My day job is as president and CEO of the Canadian Internet Registration Authority, or CIRA, and we are the country code operators for Canada. The CCNSO is the structure within ICANN that represents all CC or all country code managers around the world who choose to be members. So there isn't mandatory membership. Currently, we have 150 countries represented. There's approximately 193 UN-based countries, but we also include territories who can be members. So there's approximately 250 potential CCs, of which 150 are members of the CCNSO. That said, in terms of domain names, what's actually out there in the market, the CCNSO represents 95%+ of all domain names in the country code market. The CCNSO was founded in 2003. Originally, it was, in a sense, part of the predecessor to the GNSO structure, but as the various organizations evolved, the CC community struck out on its own, and the CCNSO was created. I think it's important to note that country codes themselves are not all uniform. We have very different structures, even though from the outside we probably, we often appear to be similar in nature, and of course we all perform a similar function as the operators of a CCTLD. But in terms of structure, we're quite different. Some are private sector, many are private not-for-profits. Sometimes they're government-run, sometimes run directly out of a government department in a given country. Some are very much for-profit type businesses. So there's a very, very wide range of governance structures, certainly very significant differences in terms of size. Largest country code operator is about 13 million domains, and we range right down to the smallest you can imagine. So there's a very wide range of types, styles, business models, governance structures, actual domain portfolio represented within the country code group. And I bring that up because it has a significant impact on how the actual CCNSO is organized and what it can do. Of course, the CCNSO, like the GNSO, has a responsibility to generate common policy for the CCNSO actors or for CCTLDs within the CCNSO. But unlike the GNSO, That's very rare that we do that, to create a policy that we can all be more or less bound to. And I say more or less, and the fact that it's very rare, because country code operators are all responsible for their country's top-level domain. And as such, there are elements of sovereignty associated with what we do. We're bound by, first, our national jurisdictions. We are not contracted to ICANN in any way, or we certainly don't have to be. Some CCs elect to be, but there's only a handful who are. And that's an important distinction. We are not contracted parties to ICANN, and we are therefore not bound by the policies of ICANN. And like I said, that's because we are first and foremost a creation of our national jurisdictions, responsible to our national jurisdictions, bound by the laws of our national jurisdictions. And that makes the CCNSO a little bit, you know, unique in the ICANN world, because we're not bound by the policies of ICANN per se. We try to be a constructive participant in the ICANN world and in the ICANN discourse as an organization, and many of the individual CCs are very, very active in the ICANN world and ICANN space, participating in the various ICANN activities, making fulsome comment into issues that are relevant in ICANN. Certainly, as I'm sure you're aware, the IANA oversight transition is one of the big issues today. And that's the kind of process that we as the CCNSO are very involved in, make comment on, have a view on, etc. But in the policy space, there are really only a couple of policies that the CCNSO has actually adopted and uniformly adopted across all of the CCs. For example, IDNs, policy around IDNs is one of them. So what do we do? We often focus on best practice issues. We're sharing information, experience, and best practice on technical issues, security, marketing, a whole range of operational issues. That's certainly part of what we do. But we also do engage significantly in the ICANN issues, particularly because the IANA function is housed within ICANN, within the ICANN family, and is one of the, on the naming side, four directly affected parties of the IANA functions, that being CC operators, G operators, the root zone maintainer, and the root operators. If you accept that those are the four directly affected parties of the IANA functions, IANA is critically important to us. In a sense, as a TLD operator, it's our number one supplier. And what happens with that function is of great interest to us. And that's one of the key reasons that CCs are very interested in what happens within the ICANN space. Additionally, there are regional organizations where CC members also participate, and those have regional interests, so it's the ICANN regions, and offer a different flavor or perspective. And those regional organizations also participate within the country code, within the CCNSO. So not only do we have 150 global CCs, but we also have a regional flavor that we can bring to the CCNSO. In terms of our structure, we have three councillors per region, the five ICANN regions. There's 15 elected councillors, or elected by their regions. We have they each have a three-year term. There are also three NOMCOM appointed councillors. The terms rotate, so every year there would be an election effectively for one of the regional councillors. And that also tries to give the organization some regional balance, some regional flavor. So there's 18 councillors in total. Currently, there's always a chair, which I currently occupy, and there's some flexibility on vice chairs. Currently, we have two vice chairs. Organizationally, as a council, have monthly meetings on a regular basis. Sometimes there's a requirement for more than that, but we have monthly teleconferences. When we're at an ICANN meeting, we meet all day Tuesday and all day Wednesday from 9 to 5. It's an open meeting, so everybody's welcome, and I would encourage you to participate. Our meeting room is on the second floor in the West Hall, so it's approximately as far as you can possibly get from this very room. That's where we meet. And like I said, the meetings are open. Everybody is welcome to sit in. The agenda is posted so you can pick issues that may be of particular interest. But we, like I say, we meet 9 to 5. We hold several large panel sessions. And in fact, today, Wednesdays, at the end of the day, we always have one of the higher profile sessions on whatever the sort of the hot topic of the ICANN meeting is. And of course, this afternoon we will be having it on issues related to the IANA transition. So that gives you a sense of the structure that we have, what we're typically engaged in, who our membership is, how we come to be as a council, and the primary focus of our work. So with that, I'd be happy to entertain any questions about the CCNSO.
Sorry, before we go to questions, I'll just let everyone know we are extremely tight for time. We already have the other presenter here, and we do have to be out of here very shortly. So if you are asking a question, please, by all means, make it very short and succinct and to the point. Yui.
Hi, my name is Dwi. I'm from Indonesia. Maybe my question is a little bit technique. Why CCTLD, or most, or I cannot say that this is all, but most CCTLD limited the utilization for a citizen, or at least have to be domicile in the country. So it's a little bit different with the new GTLD. They open without boundaries of territory. And then my next question is, by now new GTLDs, how the CCTLD will compete with new GTLD in order to, well, I mean, to get the profit or to give the more contribution to the country?
Yeah, so CCTLDs often will have different mandates than GTLDs. We are there to, and again, this isn't uniform because CCs do operate in different ways in different countries. But generally speaking, a CCTLD is there in country to provide services for the residents or organizations of the country, and hence often have some kind of presence requirement that you're a citizen, an immigrant, a permanent resident, an organization or business tied to a country. And that's specific because the CCTLDs are there for the country, not for any other jurisdiction. And that's why there's often presence requirements. There are certainly some CCs that do not have presence requirements, and they do that for reasons of their own, because the local internet community has determined that that's the path that they want to take. Most have some kind of presence requirement. Some are open. In terms of how we're going to compete against GTLDs, I would say certainly the more established or larger CCTLDs are very aware of the pending changes as a result of the opening up of the generic space. Most of us have thought quite a bit about how it's going to impact our strategy, how it's going to impact our businesses, and are making change according to what we feel the best path forward is, given a dramatically expanded market inside our own markets. I can't speak for all of them other than to say I'm well aware of the types of things that are that my colleagues are doing within Canada. As an example, we've been talking about the change in the G space for a couple of years. We've significantly adapted our strategy to what we feel will be the impact. And of course, if you have 1,000 new competitors in your backyard, yes, your landscape is going to change. We're very aware of it, and we're acting accordingly in our domestic environment. We still continue to experience strong growth in the Canadian market, and are in a good position to, I think, continue to add the service that we do, and for us, bring value to Canadians, and we would argue better value than most generics are going to be able to do.
Thank you. Martin, can you make your question extraordinarily short? We want to be fair to our next presenter.
I'll make it pretty concrete. Do CCTLDs do or need to have special considerations for national trademarks or foreign trademarks?
Sorry, special organization?
For example, if someone with a national trademark is going against someone with a international or a foreigner trademark, do the CCTLD has to give priority to the national trademark?
That's a good question, and again, I think it would depend upon the country, and actually my colleague here might be a better person to ask that question. Generally speaking, most CCs are going to have a program that follows the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy. Some will actually just mimic that. We in Canada have one that's modeled on it, which is the CDRP, Canadian Dispute Resolution Policy. We, as the CC operator, we're responsible for that process, but we don't believe we should be judge, jury, and executioner on those issues. So we outsource that to a completely independent third party who deals with those kinds of issues and who would have the actual right to a domain name based on whatever their argument may be. We pay for it, but it's completely outsourced third party, and we as a country code operator do not intervene one way or another on those kinds of disputes. Sure, go ahead.
Byron has opened the door. My name is Christina Rosette. I'm president of the Intellectual Property Constituency. I'm going to defer to Byron and his colleagues in the CCNSO as to are certain trademarks given preference at the startup. In other words, when a new second level is launched within a CC, that varies. That's not something that I have kind of country code by country code knowledge of. I will say that with regard to dispute resolution policies, although they do vary, some have adopted the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy in their entirety, some have modeled them. The one of the factors that they all seem to have in common, well, two really, are that the complaining trademark owner has to prove that the other party has no right or legitimate interest, and also that the other party has registered and used the domain name in bad faith. As a practical matter, if you have two trademark owners with competing rights, it's going to be very difficult for that complaining trademark owner to show that the other party doesn't have a right or legitimate interest or doesn't have, you know, has registered and used in bad faith. So we almost never see those disputes simply because in that case the complaining party is more often than not likely to lose. So no one initiates really a dispute that they're likely to lose. It just doesn't help them.
Yes, but my concern was that in the case of CCTLDs, I have the doubt if the CCTLD being a country code that should regard special interests of national interest, in the case of CCTLDs, the United Dispute Resolution should, I'm not saying it does, it's a doubt that I have, if they should give priority to national trademarks over foreign trademarks, just in the case of CTLDs, and I'm not saying I agree with that, it's just a doubt I have.
I can't comment for every CC out there. The common practice is in the domain industry, it's first come, first serve, period. That's kind of principle number one. And if you have a legitimate claim to that name and you're first, it'd be very hard pressed to have that overturned.
Okay, Jesus, did I interrupt?
No, that's the answer.
That was the answer. Okay, Jesus, you had a question?
Okay, just a quick question for Mr. Holland. Is there any annual payment for the CCTLD for the membership to the CCNSO?
That's a good question. That's certainly been a hot topic. As somewhat sovereign entities, our membership is quite sensitive to that, given that we are not required to participate in the ICANN environment. Unlike a contracted party like the G's are, CCs do not have to participate in the ICANN environment. And as such, we make voluntary contributions to ICANN. So there's a couple of important points there. We make it to ICANN, not to the CCNSO. So there's no fee to participate in the CCNSO. And as individual operators, we make voluntary payments to ICANN. We strongly encourage it as the CCNSO. We believe in contributing to ICANN finances. And we have just recently concluded a process by which we revise the payment structure, and most CCs are contributing to ICANN according to that payment structure, which is effectively a tiered structure that recognizes the size of a registry as a proxy for ability to pay. And the payment schedules range anywhere from about literally $500 a year for some of the very, very smallest registries, which would, their domain portfolio would number in the single-digit thousands, some of the smallest ones, up to a couple of $100,000 for the larger ones.
Yeah, thanks a lot, and a very good question, because I actually was wondering whether or not there may be support for CCs who may require some support. But we do have another question from Victoria from Moldova.
Hello, Victoria from Moldova. I would like to ask you, who should manage a situation where the country code is the same as a GTLD? For example, Moldova country code is .md, and this .md also stands for medical institution in U.S. So is the CCNSO somehow engaged in this process? Thank you.
I'm not familiar with the specific situation, but two-letter country codes, which are based off the UN country code list, are specific to countries. So in the root, in a sense, that's what defines us. Are you a UN country code associated with a particular country or territory? If so, that's reserved for country codes and are delegated as such. That gets into a relatively complicated area, but there is a process for delegation, revocation, redelegation, and retirement of top-level domains. Typically, what happens is the country code is delegated by ICANN to the relevant authority in the land. Let me just say that. Usually the government. And the government will delegate the authority to operate to some type of entity. Like I said right at the outset, that's why some of us are literally for-profit corporations, private not-for-profits, government departments, etc. Because typically the government of the land and the local internet community, depending on the type of government it is, will figure out how to run the local country code. Occasionally, governments have effectively sold them off or have some private actor run them for commercial benefit. there are still some of those around. So I'm not specifically familiar with yours. Maybe that's the case, because they certainly, if it, there are occasions where the country code is a popular acronym for something else and can be a significant revenue generator, and that has certainly happened. And particularly some of the older ones before ICANN was really organized and there was as much discipline around country code operations.
Thank you. Thank you, Byron. Unfortunately, well, first of all, thank you, Byron, and we do appreciate everything. I know there are other questions, but unfortunately, we have another presenter here who is here. So let me thank Byron Holland. Thank you very much. It's greatly appreciated. And you know, as I said before, the conversation continues offline and or at the coffee table and or between corridors and or. Jenny?
And as always, Janice did want me to remind everyone that if you have any questions for any of the presenters from this week, to go ahead and email the questions to her and she'll put you in touch.
Exactly. So please, by all means, and you know, Byron, I'm sure you're more than amenable to entertaining questions after the meeting during the day.
Absolutely. And I know Janice has forwarded questions to me previously. So please, if there are any other questions, don't hesitate to ask. And of course, as we just heard, much of the business and Q&A happens in the hallways. So you can also track me down and find us in the CCNSO meetings. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Byron. And, you know, we already saw the synergy that is actually created between the country code name supporting organization and the intellectual property, because one question that was asked, raised whether or not by Martin, raised whether or not there could be a conflict. Say somebody has registered a trademark under, is it a CC and a GTLD? But I'm not going to answer the question, but let me introduce, without any further ado, Christina Rosette, who is the chair of the Intellectual Property Constituency, which I'm sure is very interesting because those are the issues that will be discussed here. So, Christina, please take it away.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity. I am chair of the Intellectual Property Constituency, or IPC. We sit at least within the generic name supporting organization within the GNSO. And the GNSO, as I suspect you've probably heard, is divided into two houses, the contracted party house, those entities that operate under contract with ICANN, and the non-contracted party house, in other words, those that do not. So the intellectual property constituency is in the non-contracted party house, which in turn is divided into two stakeholder groups, the commercial stakeholder group and the non-commercial stakeholder group. So we sit in the commercial stakeholder group along with the ISPs, and I see that their chair, Tony Holmes, spoke with you earlier today, and the business constituency, and I believe that their chair has also spoken to you all. So we have kind of a very loose stakeholder group structure, and that really all of the primary decisions are made at the constituency level. The intellectual property constituency is responsible for representing the views and interests of intellectual property owners worldwide as they intersect with domain name system policy, and ensuring that the policy recommendations that are developed by the generic name supporting organization and that are approved and put forward to the ICANN board by the GNSO Council take those views into consideration. We have I should also say our website is ipconstituency.org, where you can find more information, including our online membership application, if you're interested. We have three categories of members. One category are are essentially international associations. A second category are national, regional, and state associations. And then the third category is comprised of individuals, whether they're individuals or entities, corporations, who participate in that way. We have about 120 members, but that number is somewhat misleading because we have so many international associations that are members. So, for example, The International Trademark Association is considered one IPC member, but it in turn has, I believe at this point, over 12,000 members. So we take input from them. They have, for example, a very active internet committee, which provides input to us as the IPC. So when you look at it as a kind of a big scale, it's a much broader representation of views and interests. In terms of how we do work, we have a very fluid structure. It's very open in the sense that if there is a new issue coming up that one of our members believes has implications for intellectual property owners and is something that we should take a position on, all that needs to be done is to really post it to our list and ask that folks take a look at it. Similarly, if there is a paper out for public comment, ICANN has put something out for public comment, and a member believes that it's something that the IPC should comment on, all they simply need to do is to make that position clear. And then a group of volunteers from a very loose committee structure will work to draft a paper, and then that's put out to our list for comment and then ultimately submitted to ICANN. In terms of the issues that we are most concerned about now, I think you've probably picked up on the fact that the entire community really is concerned about the IANA stewardship transition as well as ICANN accountability. We're not any different in that area. Those are issues that are also of great significance to us. But above and beyond that, the two that we are really focusing on for this meeting are the implementation of the new GTLD program, particularly compliance. The intellectual property constituency has had a long-running interest in working with the compliance department to ensure that because so much of ICANN, at least on the registry and registrar level, is operated under contract, that those contracts are enforced. So we're looking at issues of new GTLD implementation. One of the issues we talked about yesterday, for example, with the board, was relating to, for example, the name collision list, which I suspect Tony may have spoken to you about. And that's a list of second-level names that new GTLD registry operators can't activate for a certain period of time. Many of those lists include globally famous trademarks. And so because of that, those trademark owners haven't been able to participate in the pre-registration Sunrise program. And so how will that work? The other issue that we have had a longstanding interest in is WHOIS, which is now being referred to as Registration Directory Services. We don't have a position yet on the Expert Working Group final report that was released a couple weeks ago. We're still kind of digesting it, but I certainly expect that we will, over the next several months, develop that. Just to give you kind of a flavor of some of the just what our meetings look like, and we also meet on Constituency Day. We meet with the commercial stakeholder group for about an hour because that's how we meet with the board, is as the stakeholder group. So our meeting with the CSG is really to prepare for that, and then we'll have 3 hours of constituency meeting. So yesterday in our constituency meeting, which was open and is always open, we received briefings from the Compliance Department, the Global Domains Division, the folks on ICANN staff who are running the GNSO review, and the operators of the Trademark Clearinghouse. Then once the briefings were completed, we discussed, there's a session later this morning relating to the new TLD applicant group is running a session about what went right with this round of new GTLDs and what might not have gone so right. So I'll be participating in that. So one thing that we did was discuss what issues I should raise, what kind of positions I should be taking there. We talked about a membership outreach project that we're working on. We have three of our members are each responsible for identifying potential new members in Asia, Latin America, and Africa, particularly Category 2 or 3 members, so the associations, simply because they have a broader base of likely interest and, frankly, because of their own representative nature, would allow us to reach more more potential members. We talked about that. We gave some guidance to two of our members who are working on a working group. We gave some guidance to our GNSO counselors as to how they should vote on the motions that are being discussed today. And then we talked about the, kind of the broader issues of ICANN accountability. So that's really kind of a representative snapshot of how what we usually talk about when we have our meetings. We do have a monthly meeting by phone for all of our members on the months that we're not meeting here physically in ICANN. So I think with that, I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, Christina, let's start from the far right, my far right. Yes.
Hello, I'm Dusan from Serbia. I participated yesterday, actually assisted to intellectual property constituency, and it was really interesting. But I wanted to learn more on your position regarding the introduction of new GTLDs. We all know what the final decision of the ICANN was, and since the World Intellectual Property Organization was actually against the introduction of new GTLDs, I'm wondering whether IP constituency was at a time against or in favor. What was the internal issue within ICANN when this was decided? Thank you.
The short answer is both. In the sense that we were supportive of the introduction of internationalized domain name GTLDs, but we were concerned about and did not support kind of the whole-scale launch of non-IDN new GTLDs. The members and the interests that those members represent were very concerned about the potential for really massive cyber squatting. And when the program was initially approved, there were no required rights protection mechanisms in the program. Those really came through implementation. And we were very involved in helping to recommend those and design those and participate in those. So, you know, we still have ongoing concerns about, and that's part of the reason that we're engaging with compliance, is to make sure that to the extent that we are seeing behaviors in the new GTLD market that are not in compliance with the ICANN contracts that can harm consumers, that compliance is aware of those.
Hafid from Tunisia. I have a question related to the issues of the second level domain name listers when it comes to the brand names that are today, I mean, are not for the public. How are you dealing with this kind of issues when it comes to a domain name that is, let's say, in the postmodern situation? It's not public, it is owned by someone else, and how the Intellectual Property Institute is dealing with such kind of domain names?
If you're talking about the issue that we raised earlier, this was an issue that I think one aspect to the new GTLD program is that, unfortunately, as it moved forward into the implementation, there were solutions that needed to be implemented that hadn't been anticipated. And I think the name collision, the idea of the name collision list, the idea itself, the issue itself had been longstanding. The Security and Stability Advisory Committee had been raising it for quite some time, but it was really only, I would say probably in the last year, that it became imperative to take some kind of implementation action. And in fact, it was at the meeting in Buenos Aires that ICANN released all of the lists for all of the TLDs of the second level strings that would have to be blocked initially within each of those TLDs. So that was, you know, what, 7 months ago, barely. And so this is a situation in which one of the unanticipated consequences of having the name collision list, which I think is generally considered by the entire community to have been an important step, impacted adversely unfairly intellectual property owners, because it basically said no one can have these names for 120 days, but at that point you've already gone past the timeline when the required sunrise period is supposed to occur. So when we were talking with the board yesterday, we mentioned this as an issue that perhaps they hadn't really appreciated, that it was that ICANN's own decision was effectively circumventing their own required rights protection mechanisms, which obviously, you know, aside from substantively, from an optics perspective, it just doesn't look very good. So we raised that with them, and they recognized it, it's my understanding that they are having staff look at it, and it's something that will likely come up in the public forum on Thursday.
Excellent. Alec.
Good morning. My name is Alexander Ichokaev, coming from Macedonia. Sorry, I cannot. It's about the microphone. I'm a practicing attorney representing trademark and domain name portfolio of our clients, just like for my background. But I was involved in preparation of the application of Cyrillic IDN for Macedonia, not in depth, but I was following the process. And I would like to hear from you, do you have any position paper or comments or position paper, I would say, about the features that should be incorporated by the CCTLD manager that has applied for this IDN? That would be a general question, because I expect the second level domain names that would be registered under this Cyrillic IDN may raise some intellectual property protection issues.
We don't have anything that is specifically created for, you know, in response to any particular TLD. I think the only new GTLD that we have really individually focused on is the .sucks TLD, because one of the three applicants for that TLD has said that trademark owners will have to pay $25,000 to get the second level name that matches their trademark. So that's the only specific TLD that we've specifically said we think there's an issue here. We think this should stop. More broadly, though, the IPC has taken a number of positions in terms of the type of rights protection mechanisms that should have been required, that should be required. So what I think would probably be the best thing to do, I mean, certainly kind of the ones that are required by ICANN for the new TLDs as at a minimum, I was one of the people involved in what was referred to as the implementation recommendation team that back in, I guess it was 2009 right now, the board asked the IPC to get a group of 20 experts from around the world to come up with what should the required trademark protections be. So that IRT final report, if you're looking for what the IPC would consider to be kind of best practices, would probably be a really good starting document. So if it's not on our website, and I suspect it is, we can certainly arrange to get a copy of that to you.
Thank you. Just additional comment. You have here your position on CCTLDs dated year 2000, an old document. But there is one of the following features that should be incorporated in the management and operation of all CCTLDs. The one is famous marks. The operation of each CCTLD must provide adequate safeguards to prevent registration of domain names confusingly, or you know how it goes from IP prospects. Did you abandon this position?
I'm considered a long-time ICANN participant, and I've been involved since 2006. I actually was not aware that we had that paper, and I think it's probably important to note that the paper was likely, when we put out positions, it's usually in response to a very specific request or a framed issue. So I'd be reluctant to say, I don't think I'm comfortable saying that 14 years later, that's still the position of the IPC. But if that's something that the CCNSO or a particular CC manager thinks that we should take a look at, I'm sure we'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Alec, and thank you everybody else. The questions will keep on coming, and I want to thank everybody for being so attentive and asking very pertinent and interesting questions. I myself have a few questions, but I've deferred them to having the discussion offline. So again, the discussion continues offline. Please, by all means, do pass the questions on to Christina and her constituency via Janice, or again, if you do see her, I'm sure she's amenable to having a discussion with you at the coffee table or between meeting rooms in the corridors. All right, so please give Christina a round of applause and thank her so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Right, ladies and gentlemen, we are very limited for time, but Jorge, is it George? Yeah, yes, he is here for the group photo. So at this point in time, before, let's pass it back to Jenny.
Before everybody gets up, just a reminder, yes, we are having our photo, but also it is gala night, and so please meet in the lobby to catch the shuttles over to the gala this evening. And also remember at 5 p.m., a meeting with the SSR team in Hilton Room 1 through 6. And tomorrow morning, we will be back in the Windsor Suite at 7 a.m. Please don't be late. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jenny. So we're going to take the photo now. So first of all, we have to move fast. This room is already booked for 9 o'clock sharp start for the GAC. So can we kindly, let's find out exactly logistics-wise where we want to take the picture. So Jorge? George? Where would you like us to go? Well, we are here, so is it possible to do it inside if it's more convenient? So we could go. So can we use with this? All right. So there seems to be a problem with the room.
We should go.
Tracy.
The room is filling up.
We will get trouble. Wait, like no. Okay. All right. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, fellows. You want to say something?
Yeah.
Okay. So we will vacate the room and
tell them to follow. I'm going to follow you. So everybody follow me.
Everybody follow Jenny or Jeannie.
Thank you.
I have some pamphlets from some brochures from the ISP constituency. If you want, I also have flags for everybody. So see me if you want to get pull out a flag from your country. Yeah. A sticker flag.